What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Jacqueline and Simon Mitten, authors of the book Vera Rubin, A Life. Jacqueline, Simon, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for
having
thank
us. You.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, shall I go first?
Yeah,
you go. I'm named first on the cover, so I might as well. Well, I'm Jacqueline. I'm an astronomer by background. I wanted to do astronomy from a very early age, and I followed that through with taking a degree in physics and a PhD in astronomy. But in the end, I didn't have a research career. I've actually spent most of my life, my astronomical life, involved in bringing the subject to wider audiences in one way or another. So, for example, for quite a long period, I was the press and publicity officer for the Royal Astronomical Society in London. I've done quite a lot of writing, a lot of talking, quite a lot of media, all sorts of things. So I always reckoned I had one foot in the media and one foot in academia, if that makes any sense, because in order to keep up, it was also necessary to keep up all the connections with the professional astronomers that I know. So often going to professional meetings, keeping up with what's the latest research and so on. So also I had a long-standing interest in women in astronomy that goes right back to having not such an easy time myself. When I first started out, it was extremely unusual for women to go into astronomy. There weren't many of them. And so I've always been fascinated by the stories of other women who've succeeded in astronomy, despite the difficulties in their path. And so this was a marvellous thing to do. It was a sort of natural thing to do. I've written altogether something like 30 books as author or co-author, quite a lot for children, reference books, all sorts of things, working with other professional astronomers who are active in research. So yeah, that's roughly something about me and what I've been doing. Simon.
Hi, yes. Jacqueline and I met when we were both undergraduates at the University of Oxford. And it was at a meeting of the Oxford University Astronomical Society. I came to Cambridge in 1968 to do a doctorate at the Department of Physics in radio astronomy. After that, I had a postdoctoral spell at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge. I did that for about 5 or 6 years. And then I got headhunted by Cambridge University Press to take charge of their publishing in the physical sciences, including astronomy, astrophysics, and so on. And I enjoyed that enormously. I did it for a little over 20 years. And in the course of working on the astronomy list, I probably visited the United States 3 or 4 times a year for meetings of the American Astronomical Society and so on. So I got to know a lot of astronomers in the U.S., including Vera Rubin, and I had visited her in her place of work while I was at Cambridge University Press. So that's basically my story. When I'd had enough of being a publisher, I went back to being an academic, specializing in the history of science, particularly astronomy and biography.
So what led the two of you to decide to write a biography of Vera Rubin, and why did you both decide to make it a joint project, especially considering it sounds like that that both of you are equally qualified to tackle it on your own?
Well, the opportunity came our way. We hadn't thought of the idea, but we had a tip-off from a colleague. And that was that Harvard University Press were interested in commissioning a biography of Vera Rubin. This was less than a year after she died in December 2016. And indeed, the colleague was on the lookout to help Harvard recruit an author and somebody who we knew very well from going to the American Astronomical Society. We looked at this email that came. It was addressed originally to Simon. Simon, although I'd written a lot of books, Simon had written a biography and I hadn't. Simon had, a few years ago, wrote a biography of the cosmologist Fred Hoyle. So we looked at this and so at that time, Simon had he was just in the early stages of a rather different book project.
Yes, I'd got a big book project going at the time. This was with the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington to support one of their projects on the properties of the element carbon in the Earth's interior. And I had this large project to write a history stretching over something like 400 years on the history of the science of looking at the carbon deep in the Earth. That was a fascinating project, but it meant that I could not start work on Vera Rubin straight away, whereas Jacqueline was able to do so.
And furthermore, although Simon's always been an enthusiast for promoting women astronomers, I suppose it was a bit my territory because in some ways I could identify with Vera Rubin because I'd been through a similar kind of history of having struggles and having to make myself look plausible as a girl and a woman who wanted to do astronomy and had experience that was parallel with hers. I knew what it felt like to go and observe in a cold dome on your own and to spend hours poring over a measuring machine over plates of stellar spectra and so on. And I felt passionate for so long, really, about promoting women in astronomy. I thought this was a terrific opportunity. Well, not only that, I'd observed how much satisfaction and enjoyment Simon got out of writing the biography of Fred Hoyle. And in particular, I thought how exciting it would be to be able to go and research somebody's life right from scratch, somebody who, for whom there wasn't a biography, somebody who clearly deserved a biography, a woman so prominent, and it just sounded so exciting. I wasn't even worried about making any money out of the book. I mean, it was just wanting to do it. So it certainly wasn't the first time we would have done a project together. We've done quite a few projects.
We've done several joint projects.
And we greatly enjoy something that we can share. And so it was obvious, really. We put in a joint proposal. And in fact, it was fairly clear from the start I would probably have the time to do the bulk of the work anyway. But Simon would make a contribution, which he did, of some three chapters.
Yes.
And he would also be able to kind of bring the relevant expertise and experience of having researched a biography before. So, it didn't take much of a decision.
It didn't take much of a decision. Yeah. A further thing that was very attractive about the project was that Vera's papers were already in the Library of Congress cataloguing or assessing them had already started. We sensed that we might be the first scholars to be able to get permission to look at these papers. Fortunately for us, that is what happened. The Library of Congress was incredibly supportive and helpful. We had two-week sessions, essentially.
Fantastic trips.
Fantastic trips.
Wonderful place to work.
Going through the papers.
Yeah.
In the Library of Congress.
We certainly had a moment of panic, though, because we knew that. In fact, we'd been told by the librarian at Carnegie, where Vera Rubin had worked, that the papers had gone in 2014 to the Library of Congress, and we assumed that by 2018. It never crossed our minds. So we booked our air tickets and everything. And but I'd done my homework and I contacted the library to say, are these available in the main library or are they in stacks to be fetched? And it came back and these are only just in process of being cataloged. They're not open to the public. We had a couple of days of utter panic. But I mean, it was then wonderful because the next thing was they said, well, we'll see what we can do. And we heard directly from the archivist who was working on it. And she couldn't have been more helpful. It turned out that her son was doing a postgraduate degree in the history of science in Cambridge and that she'd taken on the Vera Rubin project because she was interested because of what he was doing. And so this connection built up and we met her on several occasions. We're in correspondence with her and it just couldn't have worked out better. So we were, and it was a lovely place to work. So yes, wonderful experience. It really did meet all those expectations of being an exciting project to share. We had, great time in Washington.
Yeah, we did.
Anyway, that's a bit of the history.
One of the things I really enjoyed in reading the book was, reading about what Vera Rubin did as an astronomer and her discoveries regarding, stellar cartography, dark matter. But that human side of her comes across very well. And I think it especially comes across very well when you're talking about her early years and what led her to become an astronomer. I was wondering if you could perhaps talk a little bit about her childhood, her family background, and why it was that she chose to undertake this, this path to becoming an astronomer, which, as you made clear, was not an easy thing to do, especially at that time.
Well, Vera was just captivated by the stars as a young girl. And again, I could really identify with this because I had exactly the same experience from about the age of seven. I just looked up and I thought, this is it. And that's exactly what Vera did. Her family, she came from a close-knit Jewish family. Her father had been brought from Eastern Europe by his parents when he was the age of seven. This is going back to about 1900. And the family were fleeing persecution of Jewish people in Eastern Europe, and they joined part of a very big migration to the United States. Her father changed his name and he came with his wife and his young family to New York State. And part of the family was already in the United States. So in fact, Vera then had quite a bit of family in the United States already. They'd settled first of all in Gloversville because her grandfather was in the glove making trade, and the family also, some of the family were in Philadelphia where they'd set up a leather goods shop. And she was actually born in Philadelphia. They moved to Washington when Vera was something like 10 years old. We learned a great deal about the background from an absolutely incredible recorded account of his early life from Vera's father, who was known as Pete. And when he was in his 80s, they got him to recount the memories of his life. And he was a tremendous raconteur. And the family, who've also been incredibly helpful to us, at one point, we didn't know about this recording. They just got in touch and they said, "We've discussed this between us. We think you should have these recordings."
Yeah.
And they are absolutely wonderful. So a lot of the colourful detail in the early chapters comes from Pete's recollection of his early life and all the things that happened, including the family coming through the Great Depression in the 1930s and what family life was like as well. So that was a tremendous resource. Anyway, they finally fetched up in Washington, D.C., and Vera and her sister Ruth had a bedroom that looked out in the northern direction. In those days, the lights weren't particularly bright in Washington, and she was able to see the stars, and she noticed that she could see the stars moving around. That's because of the rotation of the Earth. But she got fascinated, and the rest's history, as they say. she had the calling, and from there on, she was pretty well determined that she wanted to be an astronomer. And by the age of 15, she'd persuaded her father, who had a degree in electrical engineering, to help her construct a rather simple homemade telescope, and she was taking photographs of the night sky, setting a camera with the shutter open so that you get a time exposure of the stars moving around the North Celestial Pole and getting the trails. And you can see the very picture that Vera took in the book and picture of her homemade telescope. And so there was no doubt in her mind that this was the direction she was going in. She didn't know any astronomers. She certainly didn't know any female astronomers, but she knew she was going to be one. And she just,
and she was determined to go to college and do astronomy.
Absolutely. She rather went off the idea of physics. I mean, these days we would say to people, "Oh, you need to do physics, really, or mathematics, or something, if it's rather than start astronomy as an undergraduate course." She fell out with her physics teacher, who she regarded as being sexist, and by everything in her account, he was. and she was even in those days, as a rather young woman. That streak of stubbornness and determination came out. And so she came to dislike the physics classes, which was a great shame, really. But fortunately, in Vera's mind, physics and astronomy were different. She could separate the two. But it was sufficiently bad that she wanted to major in astronomy and not in physics. And that was something that stayed with her all her life, actually, that this seed of dislike that was sown by this physics teacher just shows how damaging it can be. But fortunately for us, Vera did not give up on astronomy.
I actually find that fascinating, considering that later on she ends up teaching physics at a community college, which I was thinking that must have been very interesting for her.
She didn't last long, though. She was back doing astronomy as soon as she could.
So One of the things I thought was interesting reading about her, her educational career is that when she's in college at Vassar, it's a very interesting period to be getting a degree because she is a woman who is going to college at a time when, you know, not most women didn't do that. But she's also going during the Second World War. And how that creates its own set of challenges because science is being repurposed. A lot of people are being drawn into it, but they're being drawn into various fields. And astronomy is not one of the ones that is as quite as much of a beneficiary of this as, say, electrical engineering, electronics, physics, chemistry, what have you. So what was that college experience like and in what ways was she confirmed on her course, and what were some of the challenges that she faced in terms of pursuing that astronomy-focused degree?
Well, as you say, she chose Vassar College, which was a very appropriate choice for her because Vassar College was it was founded, it still was by the time she went, as a college for women. And the very first professor of astronomy there was the United States' most famous female astronomer of the 19th century, Maria Mitchell. And Mitchell established the School of Astronomy there. She was a very, very distinguished teacher, and she set up an ethos for the teaching, which actually surpassed what was happening in many of the men's colleges at the time. She believed strongly in practical training, which was not happening, for instance, to the men who went to Harvard. And she set up this great tradition of the way astronomy would be taught in what it was, in any case, a very broad liberal arts college where many different subjects were being taught. And that tradition had been followed through with women succeeding Maria Mitchell. Her pupil and so on had succeeded as professors of astronomy. So unusually, there was a professor of astronomy and a very proud background of Vassar for its astronomy. And Matthew Vassar had also provided an enormous observatory there as well as part of the money because he was so keen to get Maria Mitchell. So it was an exceptional place for her to go. And when she arrived, it was actually 1945, the war had ended. But of course, the situation in the college was still somewhat on a wartime footing. And they even had some men students because there wasn't enough places in college and accommodation for the GIs coming back, and some of them who lived at home locally attended Vassar. And there are some considerable descriptions of how they had to sort of cope for themselves a bit. It was different. But the astronomers did find things to do that helped with the war effort. There was radio science and meteorology and various things. But certainly when Vera landed there, it was solidly traditional teaching of astronomy. And her professor was Maud Makemson, who was an expert both in orbital dynamics and more latterly in archaeoastronomy. So she was able to get her fill of astronomy there. And also there were many other things she was able to study in her course. But interestingly, she avoided physics. She didn't do any physics at all in her first year.
No.
And she had this sort of physics deficit, which she realized at some point would have to be addressed because she just needed some credits in physics. So ultimately she did do some physics, but it kind of stayed with her that the professor of physics had in a reference and said that her background was somewhat unusual in physics. It's so strange now for such a distinguished astronomer. But anyway, of course, she went through her course in flying colours with flying colours, graduated with honours. But she was able to also to graduate in 3 years because it was another of the wartime changes that they had an accelerated course where there were additional teaching weeks in the year. And students were able to graduate in 3 years instead of the usual four. So she went at 17, and by the time she finished at the age of,
barely 20, yeah.
Yes, and she immediately got married. And then, of course, that's the next stage of her education, if you're ready to move on.
Yeah, that's something that comes across during that period in particular. What you describe in the book, the expectation that people had of women going into science is that, why should we invest this time in educating you when you're going to quit as soon as you get married? And that's one of the things I thought was fascinating to read about Bob Rubin, her husband, which was the degree to which he supported her. He did a lot to make her continuing education, her pursuit of a doctorate, work, and to help her succeed in that respect. And how that was obviously was something that Vera couldn't have done if she hadn't had that determination and drive and desire to do it. But that the degree to which it was, you know, that she was really pushing against that tide of expectation, and the degree to which she, you know, needed all those elements to overcome it to eventually, you know, just simply get the doctorate, let alone pursue the career afterward.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I can tell you've read the book very, very thoroughly.
Thank you.
Vera used to say, rule number one, marry the right husband. And she was very fulsome in acknowledging Bob's support. Not only that, they shared a great love of science. He was, when she met him, he was doing a postgraduate degree in, originally chemical engineering. That had been a bit wartime. It became physical chemistry, but he was very skilled in physics, chemistry, and mathematics. And they were really able to talk science together. And this was really important.
And we know that when Vera became an early career scientist, as we would call them these days, Bob was on hand for some of the more theoretical physics that was involved. Mm-hmm. And looking through her papers and so on, one can sense a kind of invisible hand in which he's saying, well, you know, I know how we can fix this. Mm-hmm. I know how you can solve this one, Vera.
Yeah, and it's very clear that in her early papers, she was very happy to acknowledge the many discussions she had with Bob on the science stuff, but also, of course, they were deeply close in their shared wish to raise a large family. And they went about it almost as soon as they were married.
Yeah.
And didn't seem to be any question in either of their minds that it was a choice, that they wanted the family. And Vera somehow in the back of her mind knew that she wanted to be an astronomer, but during those early years, she did worry about whether she was going to be. She said over and over again, "Will I ever be an astronomer?" But you're absolutely right that it was the support of her family, and not as well as Bob, the parents who joined in. Particularly over allowing her to ultimately to do her doctorate. We've skipped over her years at Cornell a bit. So perhaps we should fill in that she went to join Bob at Cornell to do a master's degree.
Yeah.
And by the time she'd finished, she had their first son, Davy, and the future looked a bit uncertain for her. But Bob took a job at the Applied Physics Laboratory, which was located on the northern fringe of Washington, and they moved there. And within a very short time, it became clear that Vera wasn't going to settle into the life of a suburban housewife. That wasn't going to make her happy at all. And so something had to be done to get her back into college and doing a PhD. So they worked out elaborate arrangements so that she could, first of all, they had to find somewhere where she could enroll. And again, it had to be astronomy. She didn't want to go in a physics department.
No physics
department. And there was just one place, and that was Georgetown University on the on the south side of Washington, quite a little drive away from where they were living.
Yes.
She was welcomed with open arms there, despite the fact that she'd got a baby in arms and was pregnant. And the far-sighted Father Francis Haydn, who was the head of the astronomy department there, had no hesitation in enrolling her for her PhD. But it was something of a struggle. Vera said it was the hardest thing she ever did in her life, and she was burning the candle at both ends, leading a double life of being a mum of a very young family during the day, twice a week attending lectures at 6 o'clock in the evening, with an elaborate arrangement of Bob chauffeuring her there and the parents looking after the children and so on. And then she'd come home and she'd work the night shift on her graduate work. She did show that absolute grit and determination, which later I think has always held her in good stead in her her observing work, where she had the absolute stamina to be able to do long hours in an observatory dome.
One of the things that it's a point you don't make overtly in the book, but it's definitely there, is how she was doing this during a time when it seemed astronomy was really beginning to open up. The post-war years, you start to see growing interest in outer space. You have rocketry having, you know, had a huge advancement because of the war. You describe at one point how a radio telescope program that's able to take advantage of the wartime advancements and leftover technology to take a step forward. It seemed as though it was a very exciting time to be in astronomy, where people were really getting much more invested in going to the stars, in going to space, and in exploring space, and that she was a beneficiary of that, especially in terms of her postgraduate work, in terms of her employment in it, in terms of staying invested in astronomy.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's also worth pointing out that the great boom in observational astronomy that took place from about 1948. 1948 is when the 200-inch Palomar telescope opens in California. And this boom in observing the heavens using both radio telescopes and using optical telescopes is very much a West Coast phenomenon. The facilities are out west and in the southwest. Vera at Georgetown, her research there was to do with reducing data, as we call it, from eclipses of the sun, that sort of thing. And the this great expansion of astronomy, not very much of it took place in Washington. Mm-hmm. It was taking place in Charlottesville, Virginia, and also at Harvard, but most of the action was out west.
That's true with the optical astronomy, but to a certain extent, you've just referred to it, it was interesting that radio astronomy was equally taking place on the East Coast.
Yes,
and she took an early interest in what was happening in the field of radio astronomy, although it wasn't her choice of what to enter. But it was something that came back over and over again, her interest in comparing radio and optical observations of galaxies.
Yes, yeah.
And it was ultimately because she knew a radio astronomer that she ended up where she finally worked for the 50 years of her life.
That's right.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon what her specific interests were with astronomy. What aspects of astronomy really engaged her, and how did she establish a name for herself early on in developing those interests?
Vera was interested in galaxies.
Yes, that's a really important point. She was interested in galaxies. She was not interested in the theory of galaxies. She was interested in what are the properties of galaxies. How are the stars moving around in the galaxies? How are the great nebulae? What motion do they exhibit? What's going on dynamically
inside the galaxy?
Inside the galaxy. With Vera, there's one exception to this, but she did not get caught up later in her career with all the stuff to do with the very distant, very energetic things that radio astronomers and optical astronomers have been discovering, quasars, black holes, that sort of thing. She was galaxies, galaxies, galaxies.
Yes. It goes back, I think, partly to when she was a graduate student at Cornell. She was inspired there by the lectures of one of her teachers there, Martha Stair Carpenter, who was an expert on galactic dynamics. And all along, it was the idea about what is it that makes galaxies different? Now, anyone who's seen pictures of galaxies knows that they come in all manner of shapes and sizes. They're almost like human faces. No two are the same. And yet there are similarities, you know, like we've all got two eyes and a nose and so on. So galaxies can be put into broad groups. But what fascinated Vera ultimately was the idea that if she could understand how things were moving about, all the stars and the gas inside a galaxy was moving about, perhaps that would do something to explain why galaxies are different shapes and maybe how they evolve over time.
Yes, and it also, by looking at the motions, the components of the galaxy, that opens up the possibility of being able to see what the distribution of the mass is within the galaxy. And that, of course, is important for the theorists.
But, of course, she wasn't able to do any of this until she made this very important decision to change jobs.
Yes.
And the really, really important, significant thing that happened was that in 1965, for various reasons, which we probably don't have time to go into now, she decided it was time to move on from Georgetown. And she went to the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism of the Carnegie Institution of Washington, which was and still is on the north side of Washington, but has recently now become part of what's now known as the Earth and Planets Laboratory.
Yes.
So she resigned her job. She walked in there, went and saw her radio astronomy friend, Bernie Burke and said, do you know, I really fancy working here, which was an unusual thing to do because they weren't doing any optical astronomy and they'd never had a woman on the staff at all. At that time, the director there, Merle Tuve, who was also a very famous physicist, famous for many things, I won't go off on a sidetrack now, but they put a lot of effort into developing an electronic device for astronomers called an image tube, which added on top of your spectrograph that was going to take a spectrum of a star or a galaxy, would make it 10 times more sensitive to light. And this was really important because at that time, the 200-inch really had a bit of a dominance, it being the only telescope that large. And wanted to be able to do similar work with much smaller telescopes.
So the Carnegie Institution had developed this image tube concept so that existing telescopes would be able to compete with the 200-inch at Palomar for certain kinds of investigation, not every kind of investigation, but for certain categories of investigation. And that was a big breakthrough, and Vera was in the very good position of being able to demonstrate the astronomical capabilities of combining the image tube with a spectrograph.
And she was hired to do that. She turned up just at the right moment. She was hired to do it, and she formed immediately a partnership with the physicist who'd been doing the technical development, a man called Kent Ford. And they remained professional partners throughout the entire time that Ford worked there until his retirement. And you will find that all their papers are Rubin and Ford, lot of them, or sometimes with a few other authors as well. So they were a complementary team, and they had the right piece of equipment because they were able to do, Vera was able to devise an observing program that nobody else could do, really.
Yeah.
And she also just fell in love with observing. She came to observing a bit late. She was in her mid-30s before she had her first experience of observing in a dome professionally, doing serious professional observing. But she immediately fell in love with it. And she used to say she was never happier than when she was in the dome at night. So what she developed was a very great observing skill and a very strong work ethic of wanting to put in a great deal of time, of being extremely careful. And what was really important about her work was she was a great observer. She wasn't really interested in the theory. She wanted to make observations that other astronomers would be able to rely on. That she wanted other astronomers to be able to say, we're absolutely able to say that what Vera Rubin's done is the last word in these observations.
Yes.
And that was the task that she set herself. And she never set out to investigate or discover dark matter, with which she then subsequently became very much associated. This was all something that kind of happened on the side. It was almost accidental. It was a consequence of the work that Vera was already doing and had already planned to do.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit on what dark matter is and how the confirmation or evidence of it came from her observations.
If only we knew what dark matter was, Mark. we wouldn't be sitting here if we did. But
we don't know what it is. But Vera was one of the first to use the data that she had got on how stars and particularly bright nebulae are moving within the galaxy that they belong to. Because as I said earlier, you can then interpret those data in order to infer where the mass is. And what was found was that the outer parts of spiral galaxies, the stuff in orbit in the disk, was actually going faster than one would expect from the distribution of matter that you could infer just from the visible stars. And so over a period, I guess, Jacqueline, it's true to say we're talking about something that emerged rather slowly over something like 10 years, that the radio astronomers had been getting the same effect when they were looking at the velocities of hydrogen in spiral galaxies.
That's true. In many ways, the unfolding story of dark matter in this period, and we're talking about roughly 1970 to 1980. It's quite a complicated story, and it was a combination of things that were happening. Part of it were the observations, which Vera's optical work was extremely important, but she never claimed to be the first. She acknowledged that there were radio astronomers doing similar work and getting similar results at the same time, or even just before she got started on her optical work. It's often said that what Vera did persuaded more people in some ways, because radio observations seem a bit kind of obscure and more difficult for people to understand, whereas optical observations, people were able to understand more. And Vera was a very good communicator. She wrote clear papers, and she acquired enormous quantities of data. She observed very large numbers of galaxies. But Vera did not concern herself about what was causing this anomalous rotation. She noted that it happened, but she regarded it very much as the job of others to interpret why that might be. And it was also the case that there were theoretical developments going on at the same time in the early 1970s, which were equally very, very important, and those are particularly, we're talking about Jim Peebles and Jerry Ostreicher's theoretical work, which illustrated basically that a spiral galaxy, or a galaxy that's in a disk shape, just can't actually hang together and exist unless it's surrounded by a big sphere of a mass that's keeping it stable. And that was all happening at around the same time.
Yes.
And then also there was quite a lot of concern about the universe as a whole. You know, what's holding the universe as a whole together?
They had an expression, mainly the radio astronomers, they had an expression which was, the universe contains a lot of missing mass. what they meant was, they didn't know where to find it. Now, this is where Vera's stuff, the field she's working in, starts to become interesting, because eventually the people interested in the expansion of the universe and how massive is the universe they connect with those who are saying that there's this anomalous rotation in spiral galaxies, and it indicates that there's a large amount of invisible matter, maybe arranged in great halo around the galaxy, that sort of thing. And suddenly there's a connection of, maybe the unseen matter is actually the missing mass.
The people were beginning then to sort of connect the idea of what cosmologists were thinking about with what was actually being found in these halos around galaxies, for which there was no other really explanation except there must be something there that had got gravity and was pulling, but you couldn't see it and you couldn't explain it. But of course, at first, people thought, well, maybe. And in fact, in the longer history of dark matter, which goes right back to the 1930s, there had been a sprinkling of people who've made observations and said, well, it looks as if these galaxies are more massive than all the stars we can actually see. Maybe there are a lot of faint stars, or maybe there's a lot of dust we can't see or something. But nobody was really thinking of it on a grand scale of something very, very exotic. And I can still remember, I think, when we were sort of students and postdocs and so on, a lot of this discussion taking place was a lot of joking about, well, it could all be house bricks or... You know, if it was
IBM golf ball typewriters.
Even IBM golf ball typewriters. I think people used to joke and say, you know, if there were a load of those in space, you know, we wouldn't be able to detect them. It's only been very much later, really, there's been good enough observational evidence to suggest that the explanation has to be elsewhere, and it's almost certainly in some kind of mysterious particle. Well, that's what most people seem to think at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other explanations, as they say. But Vera herself didn't like being asked very much. You know, she'd often be pressed somewhat on this topic, and she backed off wanting to express much of an opinion. I don't think she very much cared for the idea originally that it was exotic particles, but she always said it was somebody else's business to sort that out.
Another characteristic of Vera, which is good to recall at this point, is she was meticulous in her use of what's called the scientific method. You know, there is a particular manner in which you make your measurements. You reduce your data, you involve colleagues, peer review, and all this sort of thing. And Vera was very precise, and her observations, as we've already said, were a very high quality. But she didn't want to get involved in kind of colliding bandwagons of theorists saying, oh, well... at Harvard, we all think it's this, or no, that's wrong. In Pasadena and at Caltech, we think it must all be that. She was very good at just quietly saying, look, we simply don't know. In other words, the data, there's not sufficient of it to be able to discriminate between all of these rival theories.
And personally, she liked a quiet life.
It
was why she stayed at DTM the whole time. It's in a sort of almost semi-rural setting, and it's a place with a very special kind of research ethos where people could get on without... too much questioning with long-term projects, no pressure to publish in the short term, no pressure to teach students. And she absolutely adored that.
Yeah.
She was never tempted away to be a big professor somewhere because she wanted the quiet life. And she said that she took on these long-term projects because nobody else was doing it. She could just get on with it. It was a good excuse for spending many weeks of the year in a dome, observing which watch what she liked. So it was very much the kind of research she really, really wanted to do.
I feel that saying that she liked a quiet life deserves a bit of qualification, because you also describe, especially as her stature in the profession grew, how she used her stature, she used her position to basically make the case for women in science. You describe her as being quite active in terms of the cause of women generally, the cause of women in society, the cause of women within astronomy, the cause of women within science more generally, and that's something that as she became more famous, as she became more renowned, that she became very committed to that, basically using her stature not just for her own professional benefit, but also for the benefit of those who hadn't even entered the profession.
Yes, that's completely true. And she had a very powerful sense of her duty and also, she was very driven as well to want to do more for women. I would stand by saying that she liked the quiet life, because although she was ready to stand up and to make her voice heard and so on, she always wanted to be able to retreat to that calm. And she wrote a most charming letter to the director at DTM, which was in the files, saying when she'd been away for 3 months being a visiting professor somewhere, just saying she was so thankful to be back at DTM and appreciating the calm and the peace, and she just thanked him for making it possible. So in a sense, I think she could do what she did because her roots were very firmly in this kind of peaceful place where she felt so comfortable and so at home. And I think perhaps that it gave her the strength to do all those other things, which were using her voice exactly as you say. And it was this stubbornness then that took over again, this absolute streak of stubbornness that when she got her teeth into something, and she was just so angry really inside about the way women were treated, that she felt really powerfully that she got to do what she could about it. But she was never angry in public. She had a wonderful sense of ironic humour, and she always argued her cases by regimenting the data, like she did with her science. That is, she would set out how many things, how many meetings had been with all male speakers and without, and how many awards had gone to men with none going to women, and how many committees there were that were all men and no women, and then she would present a list of women who were all extremely well qualified and could be approached to do this and that and so on. So she went about the whole thing in this kind of almost scientific way. Yeah. I think people didn't like to run up against Vera because she on all this, because she was quite stubborn, and she would write. For instance, she got very exercised about sexist language. She didn't like he and her, he and his, and so on. She preferred to use the plural they and their, so that it didn't sound particularly male or female, and she explained why she felt that this had an impact, and the psychological way in which it had an impact. And she would write year after year after year to the same people saying, this is my annual letter to complain about your catalogue or about your research applications or whatever. And she just didn't give up. Oh. It's just a few little anecdotes there to give a bit of insight into what she was like with that campaigning. And also, she was a person of great humanity and great kindness, and the people who encountered her and sought her help never forgot. She was truly loved.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're both working on now?
Well, right now there seems to be quite a few things in connection with the publication of the book next week. So a number of articles and blogs and things to write. We haven't started. We have some ideas, I think, for some of the books that we might want to do. But unfortunately, I think COVID is getting in the way at the moment. But there's also papers. Simon, you're busy on some papers, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm busy on doing research papers. I've been writing on the Belgian cosmologist and priest Georges Lemaître. I've done quite a few pieces on him. He's now described as being the father of the Big Bang, because he's the first one who's got an explosive expanding model of the universe that actually fits with Einstein's general theory of relativity. I've also been working on George Gamow. George Gamow was a very eclectic and imaginative physicist, and he was actually Vera Rubin's doctoral advisor, because George, until 1956, he was a professor from 1934 to 56. He was a professor of physics at George Washington University. So George Gamow sort of slightly overlaps with the world I've been accustomed to researching in Washington with Vera. So there are some things where I'm getting two for the price of one.
Yeah.
But biography of 20th century astronomers is what I like.
And perhaps we could also mention that we've also been doing a little bit of work on the history of radio astronomy in Cambridge.
Yes, we have. Because
we've had a family member who worked the entire of his career in Martin Ryle's radio astronomy group at Cambridge right from the beginning. And since he's passed on, it's emerged in the family that a large collection of the photographs and things he took and his memoirs and so on. And I'm helping my brother-in-law, who's got possession of this material, to put together a story about the radio astronomer Bruce Elsmore, who worked with Martin Ryle for all his life. So that's another little interesting thing that's on the go.
Well, those sound like fantastic projects, and I hope that when you come out with the next manuscript that we can perhaps have you back on one of our channels.
Oh, we'd love to do that.
Well, as you can tell, once we get excited, we don't mind talking.
Well, Jacqueline, Simon, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Yep. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.